was very strong in her faith. I grew up watching my mom always in her Bible. My dad and my mom got divorced when I was 3. My dad was kind of in and out of my life. My addiction started when I was in 8th grade. It began with marijuana. When I first started, it was about acceptance. I wasn't a popular girl in school. I was very overweight.
I don't think people realize, parents, how critical that age, 7th, 8th, 9th grade, those ages
and
right there.
It seems so young. Now that I look back, it's so young.
Welcome to today's episode of Falling to Freedom, where addiction ends and faith begins. The weekly podcast that brings thoughtful, informed, and challenging discussions about addiction to the forefront of everyone's minds. We join our host now, Chad Lacombe, for today's topic.
All right. Well, this afternoon we're joined by Brooke Torres, and she has an amazing story of redemption and freedom from addiction. And we really are excited to hear your story, Brooke. And I know that it will be beneficial to a lot of people that either are still struggling, maybe have family members that are struggling, or even people that have come out of it and just rejoice in a story, you know, an overcomer's story. And, you know, we are fully convinced that addiction is a whole of society problem that crosses, you know, racial, gender, socioeconomic, political, it crosses all those bounds, boundaries. You know, it doesn't really matter what a person's profession is, their, you know, educational background. Right. Everyone can find themselves in addiction's grip. And so, you know, I know your story is unique. And so I will stop talking and just ask if you could, you know, start from the beginning just to help people understand, you know, what your childhood was like, because, you know, most people may think, oh, yeah, it's, you know, people that were, you know, coming from, you know, trauma and rough childhoods. And that's true sometimes, but it's not always the case.
Right.
And so I think it's beneficial to have you share a little bit of your background to start with.
Okay.
All right.
So my name is Brooke Torres, and I'm 40 years old. My childhood, my mom was very strong in her faith. I grew up watching my mom always in her Bible, always on her knees, super strong in the Lord. My dad and my mom got divorced when I was 3. So my dad was kind of in and out of my life as a child. He didn't come to the Lord until later on in his life. So he was more prevalent in my life later on in my life. But as a child, there was that foundation that was set. So I grew up knowing about Jesus, knowing about the Lord. I moved to Las Vegas. I was born and raised in Riverside. So I was born in San Bernardino, grew up in Riverside till I was 12. Then at 12, I moved to Las Vegas with my mother and my two sisters.
Was everything pretty normal up to that point?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So we moved there, and I want to say that my addiction started when I was in 8th grade. It began with marijuana. And then, you know, for me, I feel like when I first started, it was about acceptance. Like, you know, I wasn't a popular girl in school. I was very overweight, you know. So when the opportunity, you know, these popular kids are smoking pot. So it was like, okay, I'm going to do this because, you know, it's, you know, I'm going to be popular. And when I look back at it now, it was like, I just wanted to be loved. I wanted to feel accepted. And so naturally, you know, I grew, you know, I became, you know, in the popular crowd. And then I started selling weed. And then it was like, okay, now, you know, now I'm really wanted. Now everybody's, you know, oh, you know, go to her, you know. So.
And this was in 8th grade?
This was in 9th grade. Okay. So it started, you know, it starts off slow, you know. You're just smoking weed for fun. And then it, you know, you don't think it's going to happen to you, the addiction. You think, oh, you know, I'm just doing it for fun. I'm not going to get addicted to it. And then it becomes, then it became an everyday thing. Then by the ninth grade, I started selling. And then
I don't think people realize, parents, how critical that age, like 7th, 8th, 9th grade, those ages
and
right there.
It seems so young. Now that I look back, it's so young, you know? And it is, though. It's very, because the peer pressure is real. Mm-hmm. And marijuana is a gateway drug. I do believe that. And yeah. So...
there's a lot of people that would push back against that, but my thought is... Yeah, not everyone that smokes pot goes on to other things, but everybody that I've talked to that goes on to other things smoke pot first.
Yes, absolutely.
So
yes,
it may not be a gateway drug for every single person, but it certainly was the precursor to other things in everybody that I talked to.
Right, absolutely. So then by ninth grade, the rave scene was really prevalent. And mm-hmm. so I started going to these rave parties mm-hmm. and... That's where I was introduced to ecstasy, mm-hmm. acid, shrooms, mm-hmm. cocaine.
So psychedelics.
Psychedelics were like, you know, an every weekend thing. And, you know, you think you're just having fun, but it takes a toll, you know. So then.
It's interesting because that's another one that they're trying to legalize right now. They already got the push for marijuana and now they're trying to push psychedelics
yes,
on people.
It's horrible. And mm-hmm. Then I got... introduced to methamphetamines. Mm-hmm. So methamphetamines, I just started doing it like, you know, here and there as a party thing. And then I got introduced or I started dating a very dangerous drug member. Mm-hmm. And
how old are you at this time?
I was 16 or 17.
Okay.
And he sold it.
Mm-hmm.
So now I had endless supply of it. So that addiction grew fast.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I was overweight as a child. So when I did this drug, it was like I didn't have to try. You know, mm-hmm. I did it a lot for that reason as well. And shortly after dating him, I became pregnant real short, probably 6 months after dating him. And he was abusive, very abusive. I was able to quit the meth. My addiction wasn't, I don't feel like it was, it hadn't gotten that deep yet.
Mm-hmm.
So when I did find out I was pregnant, I was able to quit. Mm-hmm. I quit and I had the baby and he beat me my whole entire pregnancy. So by the time I had the baby, I remember having, his name is Isaiah. I remember having him and he went to go hit me while I was holding him. And that was the last straw for me. And I filed a restraining order and haven't seen him to this day.
Yeah.
So.
Let me just ask you, what was your family involvement at this point? I mean, you just described a progression from smoking weed to psychedelics. You're out at raves.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like a pretty loose environment.
Well, my dad wasn't present.
Sure.
And
what
my
about
mom, my mom was trying to raise 3 kids, mm-hmm. trying to make ends meet, yeah. working day and night. I mean, she worked all hours of the night. She would do insurance claims. So yeah. She was always...
So there wasn't a lot of accountability for you.
There wasn't. And my mom did her best.
Yeah.
And she was on her knees praying for me. And and I feel like my dad not really being a part mm-hmm. of my life as a child, it did do a lot.
That's a big topic right now as well, you know.
Yeah, it did.
I mean, kudos to single mothers and just doing it. But, you know, there's something when the family unit is together, it's definitely stronger. The pieces that are there for a healthy child to grow up and a healthy family, when you have a husband and a wife and the children grow up in that environment, I think it's without question.
Yes. And my mom, you know, she tried to put me in rehab. I mean, at this time, yeah. I mean, when she found out I was addicted to pot, she did, you know, force me to go to rehab. And okay. Yeah, she was doing
it. So that was in eighth grade.
That was, well, the rehab didn't start until like ninth grade, okay. You know, because by eighth grade, I was still sneaking around and yeah. She wasn't really aware.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, she did. I put my mom through a lot.
And oh,
she,
I'm sure.
She did the best she could. And, so by the time I had my son and the restraining order was filed, you know, I had bruises all over me and I would hide it from my mom.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was, you know, I was like, oh, if he doesn't love me unless he hits me, you know, I was like in that mind state. Like I was so, my mind was so warped about it, mm-hmm. about the abuse. Mm. So then by this time I was what you would call a functioning addict. So after I had my son, mm-hmm. I started using again and I had a job. I would go to sleep every night or at least lay there with my baby every night and try to sleep. Mm-hmm. But I feel like my body got so immune to the drug that I wasn't even getting high anymore. It was mm-hmm. like I didn't feel normal unless mm-hmm. I had it. So by this time I started, you know, when you're trying to raise a kid and trying to keep up with your addiction, you're hiding in the bathroom trying to get high while your kid's out, you know, playing or whatever, it got to be stressful. Mm-hmm. And so I would drop him off to my mom. I would drop him off to my dad. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes he was bouncing around because mm-hmm. I was trying to get high. So, oh, can you watch the baby? Can you, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I would disappear and they couldn't find me, you know, because I didn't want to face them. I'd be so high mm-hmm. that it was like, I didn't want to call my mom. I didn't want to, you know, sure. So I would
the
just
guilt and the shame.
I would shut the phone off and they couldn't find me. So finally my dad was like, okay, like something's wrong. You know, now my dad's prevalent in my life. He gave his life to the Lord when I was 16, 17, mm-hmm. maybe. So that's when he started being more present. Mm-hmm. So he put two and two together and was like, you know what? You know, something's going on with my daughter mm-hmm. and they couldn't get a hold of me, mm-hmm. filed for custody. And I remember I had showed up at my mom's house one day. I'd been gone for days and she handed me the papers. Now my dad lived in California. We were still in Vegas. Mm-hmm. So by this time, I think my mom had gotten sick. So she had given Isaiah to my dad and, you know, my dad took it into his hands, filed custody and she handed me the papers and I just was so devastated because I thought in the back of my mind, oh, I can do whatever I'm doing. My baby's with my mom. My baby's with my dad. I can just continue to party and I'll get it together and I'll go back and get my kid.
How old are you at this time?
I had Isaiah when I was 17. So he was 3. When my dad...
So 20?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I felt betrayed. I felt like, how could my dad do this to me? Like, how... Like, I... Now that I look back at it, I know my dad meant, you know, he meant the best for my son. But when you're not in your right mind and you're, you know, I just felt like, oh my gosh. Like, I was just blindsided by it. You know, I thought I can get away with what I was doing. Mm-hmm. So instead of saying... Okay, I need to do something and I need to figure it out. I went deeper in my addiction because I didn't want to feel the pain. I didn't want to look at myself in the mirror. That is when I started using needles. Mm-hmm. I started shooting up. And I mean, I tried heroin, meth. Okay. I mean, I was doing anything that I could. Not, I wanted to die.
Yeah, you're in self-destruction
mode. I was in self-destruction mode, yes. So I think the first time I used needles, it was heroin, which I never got. My body never got it. I just did it because it was all that was there. And so when I think that's when I first shot up was with heroin. And then I figured out you can shoot up methamphetamines. So mm-hmm. I did that. And that was like, that just grabbed a hold of me. And by that time, I was hanging out with very dangerous people, very dangerous gang members, drug dealers, and I ended up getting arrested for possession of a stolen vehicle. Mm-hmm. My boyfriend at the time was stealing cars and doing this and that, so I was, you know, he was abusive as well, and he kind of mm-hmm. forced me into, you're going to drive this car, and I was like, okay, you know, so... I did, got pulled over. They put me on probation and I couldn't pass the drug test. Like I went for like 2 years. I was dodging the probation officer here and there. Finally ended up coming up dirty a couple times, and they said, you're done. So went to the judge, got sentenced to 12 to 36 months in Nevada State Penitentiary. I only ended up doing like 6 months. They let me out. And I still continued after that. You know, that wasn't even my breaking point. Mm-hmm. I got out, was sober for a little while.
Let me ask you a question real quick, because it's relevant to a conversation that is happening right now. And that's, you know, California's stance is called harm reduction, right? And so they are basically advocating for a person in that situation. There shouldn't be any punitive, you know, consequences for what they did. You should just help them, you know, to hopefully, you know, if they decide that they want to go get help, fine. If not, then just make them safe, give them clean needles, give them a safe place to shoot up, but no, like, punitive consequences for it.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious about your thought. In hindsight, was the time that you did
sufficient
in prison, no, not sufficient, but beneficial or harmful in the long run? Now, at the time, you probably didn't feel like that, but was it a contributing factor to, you know, pushing you towards getting help, right?
I feel like I always found the Lord when I was incarcerated, when I was in jail, when I was away from it was just me and the Lord.
Yeah.
I, you know, because even though I was in my addiction, I believed in Jesus. Mm-hmm. I mean, I cried out to Jesus, Lord, take this from me. Like, that's why it's like he did it, you know? So I think that if I would have had to do the full 12 to 36 months, that would have set a
might have been better.
Yes. I do agree. I agree with that. I think that letting me out at 6 months, it wasn't enough time to, you know, it was like, you know, because I just, when I was in jail, when I was, you know, I'm strong with the Lord. I want to do what's right. And then it's just, it's not.
And it gives you some time to be separated from
those
things.
Yeah, yes.
Know, the argument that a lot of people are making is, oh no, now you're putting somebody in the system and they're going to be just a part of the system and they're going to be worse off. And I don't know, that wasn't really my experience. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, just what you said, it gives you a time to be free to really gather your thoughts.
Yeah, and it's just you and God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a believer and you believe in Jesus, that's...
But even if you're not a believer,
yeah,
it's a time to just reflect on what you're doing to your life.
Yes. Yeah, I agree.
Rather than encouraging someone, you know, either intentionally or unintentionally by providing them safe place to shoot up and needles and...
They're enabling.
Yeah, well, yep. That's the way I feel.
Yeah.
But that's not California's policy, and there's a lot of people that are pushing for that type of approach and, you know, basically saying that that's the compassionate approach, right? And
right.
I know from my own experience, and you're saying from your experience, that's just not the way it works out.
Yeah, I feel if I had longer time, then I feel I would have had more of a chance to keep going.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have enough time to sit there in my thoughts. It was only 6 months.
Okay, so you have a couple of dirty drug tests. They send you to prison.
For 12 to 36.
And you're there for six months. And then what happens after that?
So I get out and I go right back. I mean, I was maybe sober a few months and I go right back into it. By this time, my son is still with my father. Mm-hmm. I think because I ended up going to prison almost like right away. Like, it just, well, I was spiraling when my son got taken. So my son was probably five or six. Mm-hmm. Then I met my husband at the age of 25, and he was a heroin addict. We met at one of my friend's house that I was getting high at, one of his friend's house that he was getting high at. And we just gravitated towards each other and we started dating. And then it just continued for years until my son was 10, Isaiah. I ended up getting pregnant, and I remember my husband was, I think he had just got extradited to San Diego. He was fighting a case in San Diego. Mm-hmm. So I remember calling him.
You were married at this time?
No.
Okay.
No. We've been together for 15 years, but we just recently got married over a year ago.
Not the typical story where people meet.
No.
In the drug house, right?
No.
Usually people meet and then one of them does drugs and it causes, you know, something to happen.
Yeah, we were both addicts. And we had tried before to go to rehab together. Mm-hmm. Not the same rehab, but we had over and over, we were done with the life. We kept telling each other, like, I kept saying, like, I want to get my son back. Sure. Like, let's just do it. He was tired. I was tired. Yeah. We tried the rehab and we always failed. Mm-hmm. And
Were secular rehabs?
Salvation Army.
Oh, okay.
So I did, Salvation Army was great. And I hung out for 4 months and I ended up, it was a 6 month program and I ended up leaving at 4 months. So I think Salvation Army's great. I mean, I just didn't complete it. So I ended up calling my husband and saying, you know, I'm pregnant. And if I do not get out of Las Vegas, it's not going to be good. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm either going to lose this baby. My drug addiction was that bad to, I don't know if I would have been able to stop using. Mm. So he was like, okay. He was like, come down. I'm in San Diego. Come down to San Diego. So I left on my 30th birthday. Mm-hmm. And that was last time I used. So it was 10 years ago. I left. I was broken. I didn't know. We didn't have nowhere to live. I had a car. So I went down there.
So you were living in your car?
We were living in the car. We were on the streets. We were just trying to make ends meet, trying to come. We were sober, but we were trying to, we were like, you know, stealing food, you know, just trying to get a hotel room, just. But we kept going and, he ended up getting on methadone, which he was able eventually to taper down. And now that I look back, I just see God's hand in all of it. I just see like every little step, you know, the verse that says, never despise small beginnings, Yes, I see it. And, you know, I just see him. And even though we would go to church periodically, but we weren't surrendered to the Lord. We still believed in Jesus, but he wasn't at the center. Then he ended up, you know, telling me, if I continue doing this, if I continue stealing, I'm going to end up going to jail. And, you know, so I need to look for a job.
The Lord told you this or your husband?
My husband. I'm sorry. So he ended up getting a job, $14 an hour. And then we ended up moving from a hotel room into a trailer, then into an apartment. And I just seen, you know, just the Lord just, you know, so, and here we are, 10 years clean.
Okay. So, wow. So it sounds like, you know, when you got clean, it wasn't necessarily a program that you went through. No. It was just like, you guys.
Well, this is what I want to say about that is, you know, with my addiction, it wasn't just the drugs. It was everything that came along with it.
The lifestyle.
It was the people. It was the place. Mm-hmm. It was all that. So I knew that we had to exit ourselves out of that and start all the way over where we didn't know anybody, where it was a brand new beginning. Mm-hmm. I know that if I would have stayed in Vegas,
But you still could have went and looked for it in San Diego but you didn't.
So I could have.
Something, you know, maybe it was the weight of the new baby. I don't know what.
Well, and that's the other thing is losing my child was, it's a wound that no mother should have to go through, even though it was on me. Mm-hmm. The drug addiction was that strong you know, that I abandoned my child.
But in hindsight, you think it was the right move? It was painful as it was? I mean, on your dad's part?
Yeah, no, I, I, I agree.
The reason I ask is I'm sure there's a lot of ladies that,
there is, but with the difference between my dad never wanted, by the time I got clean, he didn't want to give me my child back. Mm. So I got clean when it, he wasn't, it wasn't like, okay, you get clean, daughter, and here he's ready to go. Mm-hmm. He had built that relationship with my son to where it was.
I felt like his kid.
Yes. And I, you know, I can't be mad at that. And at the time, I could tell that I was in and out of my son's life so much that I felt like he was nervous around me. Mm. So I don't want to uproot him out of what he's got going on because of what I did.
Sure.
You know, I don't want to disrupt his life. And he was happy. He had friends. He had, you know.
Oh, what a difficult situation.
Yeah, it was. And so I felt like I was doing the right thing by not fighting. Mm-hmm. You know, not fighting for him. And it was hard. I didn't have birthdays with him. I didn't have Christmas with him. I wasn't allowed inside my dad's house. There was a division between me and my stepmom. So, you know, after I got clean, she wasn't welcoming to me. So I wasn't allowed inside their house. I wasn't welcome. I just had to get out of there. And it was, you know, God gave me a second chance at being a mother. Mm-hmm. He's restored so much in my life. You know, I get to plant the seed. You know, I got a second chance at being a mom, and I am a present mom now to Isaiah and to Joey.
So Isaiah is back in your
life. Isaiah moved in with me 4 years ago, and that's where my full surrender to the Lord takes place. My dad died. So when my son was 17, my dad calls me and he says, "Your son's ready to move in with you." And I was just like, oh my God,
out of the blue.
He was like, "Your son's ready." And I was like, "Okay, are you ready for this, Dad?" You know? And he was like, "Yeah, it's time." And I was like, "Okay." So I was nervous and, but I of course was thrilled. And so he moves in with me, and my dad, a week later, my dad got COVID and died. A week. I had my son for 1 week and my dad died. And, you know, through my sobriety, when I got clean, I grew very close to my dad. He was like my best friend. Mm. He had my child, so naturally I was constantly talking with him. He had the joy of the Lord. He was everything to me. So the abrupt of his death, I didn't know what to do with that pain. And so I just...
But you didn't use again?
I didn't use again. I did start drinking. Mm-hmm. I had started drinking, and I was numbing, you know, that pain with the alcohol, and I find, you know, it was just chaotic. My life was just a mess, and I got down on my knees and I said, "Lord, I can't, you know, I wasn't married still. I was living in sin. You know, I was trying to walk my son who just moved in with me, now losing, you know, a parental figure. So my life was a mess, and I got on my knees. I remember I was in the kitchen. I got on my knees, and I said, "Lord, I can't. Like, this pain is just runs deep. Like, I can't do it." And that was when I went full in. I put the Lord first. Me and my husband got married.
A complete surrender.
I watched my husband give his life to the Lord. The Lord is my top priority. He is first and foremost. And just the fact that I'm alive here today talking to you is a miracle. My dad used to always tell me, "Daughter," when I got clean, he would always say, "Daughter, you're a miracle." And so it's hard for me to tell my testimony because I'm new at it. I'm just starting out. And I do get nervous, and I'm trying to be strong and courageous.
Well, there's a lot of pain there. There's a lot of cause for guilt and shame, and yet, you know, you seem at peace. I can only imagine that comes from your relationship with the Lord.
Yeah, yeah. He's just, I'm still in my healing process.
Yeah.
He's still healing me. So, but.
So what's going on now? I mean, it sounds like, you know, you're married now.
Yeah. So this year has been, this year has been huge because we just got married a little over a year ago. And that was real heavy. That was like, we've been together for a long time living in sin. And I feel like we had one foot in with the Lord and one foot out because we knew we were, you know, living it the way we were. But the day we got married, we got on our hands and knees and we just asked the Lord to forgive us. And I just feel like with the Lord at the center of our family, of our relationship, it's just, I've got one of the biggest blessings is watching my husband grow in the Lord. You know, the other day I was doing the dishes and I overheard him talking to one of his friends on the phone, and I heard he was witnessing to him. And I just started crying, and I was just like, wow, Lord, like, you did that. Like, you did that. You know, this is somebody that I used to be scared every time he went to the bathroom because I didn't know if he was going to walk out of that bathroom alive. You know, and I just, it's overwhelming, you know, because not only did he break my chains, but he broke my husband's chains. So it is overwhelming, and I praise the Lord all the time. But we did start a homeless ministry, just me and my husband. It was on our heart, so we haven't done it in a while because work's been busy, but we go out and we just, you know, we make 10 plates of food and we hold hands with people that are struggling with addiction, and we try to tell them our testimony. We give them food, we give them Bibles, we hug them, you know, we just love on them. And I feel like it's a very strong, my husband was more of the, in, you know, I was homeless, but I was like in the car, in the hotel homeless. He was on the streets homeless. So it's important to him. Yeah. It's real important to him.
It's a healthy thing.
It is.
Serve other people.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And now is he still working that $14 an hour job?
No. And that's, that's the other thing. I've watched the Lord grow his business. He went out on his own. He took a step of faith and got his HVAC contractor's license. Okay. So started his own business. And I've watched the Lord just flourish it from the bottom. From the bottom up, I've just watched. And it's amazing to watch.
So homeless junkies. Now,
yeah,
married, godly parents with their own business. Yes. This is only possible, you know,
God
with
did it.
The Lord opening those doors and transforming a heart.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely. And the other thing is he brought me amazing, godly women that have just are so full of wisdom and they love me and they don't judge me. And I've never had that. I've never had like good, healthy friendships that are from the Lord. I've never had it. And so I used to pray to the Lord for wisdom. And I do believe it comes in various forms. And I was thinking about that a few months ago and I just was like amazed by it. And I was like, wow, you know, because the Christian walk isn't meant to be walked alone. And I didn't realize that until recently. And it's
no Lone Ranger Christians.
No, it's like the fellowship important. It's so important.
And even accountability.
All that.
Having people in your life.
Encouragement, all of
encouragement.
It.
Encouragement. Yes. Yeah, definitely. Well, I would like to ask your opinion and what advice you would give, you know, to people that may be going through similar things. So we could just start with, you know, let's say a woman that is out there and she's in addiction. Maybe she's on the verge of losing a child, or maybe she already has. You know, what advice would you give to that woman that is still struggling?
My advice would be to do it now. Get help now. Yes, rehab, I may have left rehab, but I'm not saying that rehab isn't helpful.
Sure.
Because when I was in rehab, I was doing great. I was very close to the Lord. I regret not fighting for my child. I regret that. Yeah. Even though the more years that you lose with your child, the more devastating it's going to be for him. There's a lot of healing that I've done that needs to take place in my child. Mm-hmm. And I see that now, you know, all the years that I was absent.
Every year it just would get worse and worse, you know? Mm-hmm. So the advice I'm hearing is don't wait.
Don't wait. Get help. Check yourself into rehab. If you mess up, do it again and keep going. Keep, you know.
Yeah.
You know, if you relapse, get back in there. Mm. Check yourself back into rehab.
And then what about, you know, any advice you would give or suggestions for family members or parents that may have a child that is using, you know, and obviously that person has to make the decision themselves.
Yeah.
Right? What is, you know, what advice would you give to that person?
To not give up on them.
Yeah.
To not stop praying. Mm. If you're a believer, just keep praying like the persistent widow.
Mm-hmm.
Don't stop. Don't give up on them. Don't give up on them.
It's good stuff. Well, Brooke, thanks for coming and sitting with me and sharing your story. I know it's going to be a blessing and help, you know, many people. So thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for being a part of this much needed conversation as we expose the raw truths about addiction. Don't forget to like, follow, and most importantly, share. Remember, addiction is the dirty little secret that every family deals with, but nobody wants to talk about.